We have allowed polluters to take over this process.
But do you think the fossil fuel lobbyists should be banned?
Absolutely, like we did in our fight against tobacco. WHO did not allow the tobacco industry to have a seat at the table. Why are we allowing the fossil fuel lobbyists to negotiate? It's like inviting arsonists to tell us how to put out the fire.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of arsonists right now.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
You know what I
mean? I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves, the public airwaves, and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. We will get to those arsonists telling us all how to put out the fires momentarily, and we will be joined for that by one of our favorite guests here to speak about them and those arsonists. But first, I think we can chalk up today, Desi Doyen, another win for New York State Attorney General Letitia James.
Good.
Over Donald Trump. And this must be, I gotta say, driving him crazy. Now, I know that's a very short drive at this point, but this must be driving him nuts. James, of course, famously won her civil fraud lawsuit against Trump and his company and his top executives last year, including his two eldest sons, alleging that for years, Trump had lied about his company's net worth and about his own net worth, often by hundreds of millions of dollars, in order to receive favorable rates for bank loans and on insurance and tax rates, etc. She also helped oversee the criminal case against Trump in New York when he was found guilty of 43 felony counts related to his hush money payoffs to a porn star before the 2016 election. And in response to all of that, after winning the presidency again in 2024, well, Donald Trump has been, as you may have heard, desperately trying to weaponize the Department of Justice against Tish James. Now, he fired the U.S. attorney in Virginia that he had appointed there in the Eastern District of Virginia, after that prosecutor declined to indict Tish James on apparently absurd claims of mortgage fraud. Trump then installed his own personal insurance lawyer, Lindsay Halligan, a 34-year-old woman with zero prosecutorial experience, to be the top prosecutor in this busy office in the Eastern District of Virginia, named her the U.S. attorney there so that she could, just days later, well, first indict former FBI Director James Comey, another one of Trump's political foes, for allegedly lying to Congress, and then days later indicting Tish James for supposed mortgage fraud in Virginia. Now, 2 weeks ago, both of those cases were tossed out by a federal judge after it was determined that Halligan had been unlawfully appointed by Trump to serve in the role of U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. So when they tossed her out, they also tossed out the cases against James and Comey. But of course, Trump never gives up on his revenge, as we all know by now. So last week, after nobody in the Virginia office was willing to bring the indictment against Letitia James, the DOJ brought in a prosecutor from Missouri who attempted to seek a re-indictment by a grand jury against James, of the case that had been tossed out just days earlier. They haven't yet tried to reindict James Comey because the crime that he supposedly committed, the statute of limitations has run out on that. But that hasn't kept them from going after Letitia James. So they got this new guy from Missouri and brought him in to try to indict all over again, anew, against Tish James. Well, getting a grand jury to agree to indict someone is usually pretty easy, notoriously easy. Grand juries are only given the case by the prosecutors. The grand jury only hears their side. The defense never presents its own case. And the grand jury only needs to find probable cause that the accused committed the crime, as opposed to, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, as is the case for the trial jury. So it's really easy to get an indictment. It's why, famously, there's the joke that prosecutors can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Well, the grand jury who heard this new prosecutor's allegations against Tish James last week in the attempted re-indictment against her, they refused to agree to do so. They refused to indict her, which almost never happens. Trump might have had better luck against the ham sandwich, it seems. Now, he could try a third time, but we'll see if that ever happens. So chalk up yet another win to Tish James against Donald Trump. In the meantime, on Monday night, James won yet another case against Donald Trump. This one in a case that was filed against one of Trump's day one executive orders that he signed upon taking office for his second term. The AP reported last night, a federal judge on Monday struck down President Donald Trump's executive order blocking wind energy projects, saying that the effort to halt virtually all leasing of wind farms on federal lands and federal waters was, quote, arbitrary and capricious and violates U.S. law. Judge Patty Saris of the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts vacated Donald Trump's January 21 executive order blocking wind energy projects and declared it to be unlawful. Judge Saris ruled in favor of a coalition of state attorneys general from 17 states and Washington, D.C., led by, that's right, New York Attorney General Letitia James. The group challenged Trump's day one order that paused leasing and permitting for all wind energy projects. Trump, AP notes, has been hostile to renewable energy, particularly offshore wind.
That's understating it, but yes.
Yeah, well, because in another grudge that he has held for years now, he's claimed that offshore wind projects somehow sullied the beautiful view from one of his golf courses in Scotland. And he has been pretending ever since that wind is too expensive, it's dangerous, it kills whales.
He's lying about all of it.
It kills birds, all sorts of nonsense since then. And by the way, skyscrapers, the type that Donald Trump builds, mm-hmm, actually kills more birds than do
magnitudes, orders of magnitudes
wind
more.
Energy, yeah. Anyway, since taking office a second time, he's prioritized expensive and, dangerous fossil fuel projects to produce electricity, which, of course, is no surprise, given that the fossil fuel industry gave hundreds of millions of dollars to his campaign last year in hopes that he would do exactly that in an effort to forestall the inevitable move. I think it's inevitable. To the move to cheaper, cleaner electricity sources amid our worsening climate crisis caused by the burning of fossil fuels. Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell hailed the ruling on Monday as victory for green jobs and renewable energy, noting, quote, Massachusetts has invested hundreds of millions of dollars into offshore wind, and today we successfully protected those important investments from the Trump administration's unlawful order. New York Attorney General Tish James said that she was grateful that the court stepped in, quote, to block the administration's reckless and unlawful crusade against clean energy. Quote, as New Yorkers face rising energy costs, we need more energy sources, not fewer, James said. Wind energy is good for our environment, our economy, and our communities. White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers claimed on Monday night that offshore wind projects were given unfair preferential treatment during the Biden administration, while the rest of the energy industry was hindered by burdensome regulations, saying in a statement to AP, quote, President Trump has ended Joe Biden's war on American energy and unleashed America's energy dominance to protect our economic and national security. Now, I guess you could make the argument that Biden favored renewable energy over fossil fuels because he wasn't a megalomaniacal madman. And you could certainly make the argument that Trump favors fossil fuels over cheaper, cleaner, safer, renewable energy sources. But you cannot say that Trump is somehow trying to end a, quote, war on American energy, because, yes, as it turns out, wind and solar and geothermal and battery storage projects, which Donald Trump has been actively trying to undermine since day one, they also count as, yes, American energy.
Yes, they do. And that's something that you'll see across the entire corporate media. And it has been creeping in for more than a decade now, where reporters will actually write that it's American energy without specifying that they're talking about fossil fuel energy.
Right. You if you're fighting for American energy, but you're killing ongoing wind and solar and other renewable energy projects, you are not fighting for American energy. You're fighting for the fossil fuel industry.
Right. And it's fossil fuel industry propaganda that has seeped into all of that coverage. But yeah, as you note, you know, I mean, clean energy is hanging on across the United States despite the Trump administration's efforts to kill it. And they are working very hard to kill it.
The coalition that opposed Trump's executive order and successfully won their case on Monday, at least in the lower courts, argued that Trump does not have the authority to halt project permitting and that doing so jeopardizes the state's economies, energy mix, public health, and climate goals.
All true.
The coalition includes Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, Washington State, and Washington, D.C. They say they have invested hundreds of millions of dollars collectively to develop wind energy and even more on upgrading transmission lines to bring wind energy to the electrical grid. Trump's federal government argued that the state's claims amount to nothing more than a policy disagreement over preferences for wind versus fossil fuel energy development that is outside the federal court's jurisdiction. So they're saying that the court can have no say in response to an executive order by Trump. The court disagreed. Wind is the largest source of renewable energy in the U.S. It provides around 10% of the electricity generated in the nation at this time, that according to the American Clean Power Association. And Trump has been attempting to block it since taking office, including trying to shut down offshore wind projects in which millions had already been invested and most of the work already completed. Marguerite Wells, the executive director of the Alliance for Clean Energy New York, said that wind is, quote, currently one of the most cost-effective ways to generate power. It's being used successfully not only in the U.S., but across the world. And she added, with this ruling behind us, projects can now be judged on their merits. Well, we will see. We'll see if the Trump administration decides to appeal this up to its corrupt friends on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Kit Kennedy of the Natural Resources Defense Council called the decision a win for consumers, union workers, U.S. businesses, clean air, and the climate. Quote, from the beginning of its time in office, the administration put a halt to wind energy projects that are needed to keep utility bills in check and the grid reliable. The wind order, she said, has been a devastating blow. I see what she did there to workers, electricity customers, the reliability of the grid. She said, adding that the Trump administration should use this ruling as a wake-up call stop its illegal actions and get out of the way of the expansion of renewable energy. Think they'll do that?
Unlikely.
To that end, we will be joined momentarily by renowned climate scientist and longtime friend of this program, Dr. Michael E. Mann, to discuss the disappointing end of the recent UN climate conference down in Brazil, which wrapped up while we were off for our Thanksgiving break. How the U.S., under the Trump administration, has now officially joined the world's authoritarian petrostates like Saudi Arabia and Russia, trying to block the world's transition away from fossil fuels. The deadly, irreversible outcome of what will happen if they are successful in doing so in their dangerous, petulant game. And we'll also try to talk about some of the other propagandists and techno bros out there. Yes, in this case, talking to you, Bill Gates, who are helping those authoritarians. By the way, while I don't have time to get into the details on this today, ProPublica on Monday published a report on how, oops, Donald Trump himself appears to have committed the very same type of mortgage fraud that his administration is trying and failing to indict both Letitia James for and Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook for. Trump apparently back in the 1990s took out mortgages for two different properties next door to Mar-a-Lago, claiming both would be his permanent residence, even though he never lived in either of them. He lived up in New York. That's what they're trying to use against Tish James. Good luck on all of that. Anyway, more on that in the future. But for now, let's take a quick break. And we're back with the great Dr. Michael E. Mann on the latest way that the Trump administration is risking your life along with your kids and your grandkids and your great-grandkids on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, according to new data out from the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service, shortly before airtime today, 2025 is now set to be the world's second or maybe third warmest on record globally, potentially surpassed only by 2024's all-time record-breaking heat. The data is the latest from the European Climate Service following last month's 30th annual UN Climate Summit, known as the Conference of Parties or COP30, where world governments failed to agree to substantial new measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Brazil, reflecting, as Reuters described it, strained geopolitics as the U.S., under the destructive leadership of Donald Trump on behalf of the fossil fuel industry, continues to roll back its efforts and as some countries seek to weaken CO2 cutting measures targeted with the Paris Climate Agreement back in 2015 at COP21 in France. According to Copernicus, today, this year, will also likely round out the first three-year period in which the average global temperature exceeded 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming above the pre-industrial period when humans began burning fossil fuels on an industrial scale. Staying below that 1.5 degrees of warming to try and avoid the worst consequences of our climate crisis was a key target of the Paris Climate Pact, agreed to at the time by all parties at that year's conference 10 years ago. The 10 years since that agreement have been the 10 warmest years on record since record keeping began, according to the World Meteorological Organization earlier this year. The world has not yet technically, however, breached the Paris target, which refers to an average global temperature of 1.5 Celsius over decades. But the UN said this year that the 1.5 Celsius degree goal can no longer realistically be met, and it urged governments to cut CO2 emissions faster, much faster, to limit overshooting the target. But the results coming out of this year's COP30 summit in Brazil were not encouraging. As NPR described it late last month, this year's United Nations Global Conference in Brazil ended with a formal agreement that failed to address phasing out fossil fuels, the main driver of global warming. The United States, they note, was conspicuously absent from this year's talks after the Trump administration refused to send a delegation. In the end, the conference delivered only modest progress at best on international efforts to curb global warming and pay for the costs of adapting to a hotter planet. Earlier in the week, before the conference's close, more than 80 countries had demanded that negotiators agree to a so-called roadmap to transition the global economy away from fossil fuels. That group included many developing nations hit hard by climate change, along with major emitters like the United Kingdom and Germany, and even top oil-producing nations like Mexico and Brazil. They said world leaders need to start drawing up concrete plans to reduce the use of oil, coal, and natural gas. However, major fossil fuel producers, including Russia and Saudi Arabia, and now, sadly, the U.S., have opposed the creation of a process of any process or any timetable to move away from those dirty, dangerous energy resources. In the end, to the disappointment of many, COP30's formal agreement, which is, according to longstanding conference tradition, a statement agreed upon by all member nations, well, it did not include any mention of fossil fuels whatsoever. That, even though 2 years ago in Dubai, at COP28, countries for the very first time called for a transition away from fossil fuels. This year, apparently they'd rather not even mention it. The president of this year's summit in Brazil acknowledged that many countries had wanted a more ambitious agreement. 24 countries have now said that they will work alongside the UN in a new process focused on transitioning away from fossil fuels. In April, Colombia and the Netherlands plan to host the first international conference focused specifically, as I understand it, on the issue of transitioning away from fossil fuels entirely. Beyond that, the next conference of parties, COP31, is scheduled for next year in Turkey, an authoritarian petrostate that has not been particularly friendly to the conference over the years. Meanwhile, back here at home, as the conference wrapped up last month, Dr. Michael E. Mann, one of the nation's leading climate scientists, and indeed one of the globe's leading climate scientists, as the author of more than 160 peer-reviewed and edited publications, and one of the world's great communicators on climate, as the author of countless landmark books on the topic, he decried the failures of the Brazil conference in a brief piece titled Bad COP, in which he laments that COP30 may have been the last opportunity for the nations of the world to reach an agreement that limits planetary warming below catastrophic levels. He writes that by that criterion alone, the now completed COP30 conference was an abject failure. He goes on to suggest that it might be time for a new format for these world summits if we are to even have a chance of transitioning to a more livable planet. Scientists have loudly been warning that we must for decades now, a task made even more difficult now as AI technology data centers have spiked demand for new sources of energy. So what made the Brazil summit a failure? What are now the costs of that failure? And what are the stakes for determining how this critical mission must be course corrected and quickly? Well, those are just some of the questions that I have for Dr. Mann today, who serves as the Presidential Distinguished Professor of Earth and Environmental Science, the Director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and Media, as well as Vice Provost of Climate Science, Action, and Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also, as noted, the author of a whole bunch of important and accessible books on our quickly worsening climate crisis, including his latest, co-authored with Dr. Peter Hotez, titled Science Under Siege: How to Fight the 5 Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. Oh, Dr. Michael Mann, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
It's great to be with you, Brad. I should add one short correction.
Yeah.
I actually stepped down from that vice provost role a couple months ago, in part because I felt I needed to be free to talk about the climate crisis in, you know, as frankly as I possibly can, just given the moment that we're in and the challenges we face. And with a policy of institutional neutrality as a university administrator, I wouldn't have been really able to sort of speak in the way I feel I need to speak right now, given everything you've just outlined so well. I almost feel like our conversation isn't necessary. You've spelled it out extremely well.
Well,
you know, yeah.
Don't worry. I got plenty to, I got plenty to ask you about. And if you wanted to be free to speak, this is the place to do it, Mike.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I was just going to say, this isn't sort of the cheery holiday conversation that we might like to have. But, you know, this is where we are.
Well, don't let everyone know that in advance, Mike. We have, we have become sort of used to these annual climate conferences after, you know, 2 weeks of bickering at these things. They sort of come together at the 11th hour and pull a rabbit out of the hat with a consensus agreement that everyone, all the parties sign on to help, you know, to move us forward, is sometimes incrementally, sometimes in much larger steps, as with the Paris Agreement. That does not seem to have happened at this year's COP summit, does it?
No, and there's something, you know, some of what we might view as past successes are a little bit illusory, really, because it's obvious that there hasn't been a commitment to do what we ultimately need to do, which is to phase out fossil fuels. That language has never been accepted. And the reason I outline this in my piece, the bad COP piece, is that, you know, the interpretation of the consensus rules thus far by the IPCC, they interpret consensus as meaning every single country has to agree to the language. And the problem is that you have a small number of bad actors, Saudi Arabia, Russia, authoritarian petrostates, as you describe, accurately describe some of these countries, but leading among them, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and now the United States. We have to view the United States as part of that, what I sometimes call the coalition of the unwilling. A small number of fossil fuel-driven countries that are doing everything they can to block a global agreement. And the problem here is that in order to change the IPCC rules, you actually need unanimity. You need every country to agree to it. But consensus is not unanimity. And the current language very clearly states that there needs to be a consensus of the participating countries. Consensus is not unanimity. It doesn't mean every single country needs to agree. And the problem is, in my view, that the UN has shown no backbone here by being unwilling to interpret the existing language in a way that allows for meaningful progress. We're not going to get Russia on board. We're not going to get Saudi Arabia on board. We're not going to get the United States on board as long as Donald Trump or Republicans, frankly, are in control of the federal government. But there are, you know, the vast majority of other countries in the world would be willing to commit to far more aggressive action.
Well, when it comes to the United States, I mean, we didn't even show up. So, I mean, how could we agree to anything if we're not even there to do it?
Yeah, I mean, we're the world's largest cumulative polluter, and that's all that matters. How much total fossil fuels you've burned and carbon you've added to the atmosphere, that's all the climate system cares about, and we've contributed more to it than any other country. And so for us to be AWOL in the way that we were sends the worst possible message to the rest of the world. As I said, the United States currently is actually leading. It isn't just a member of that coalition of the unwilling. It's leading it.
What is the reason, you know, given all that we are seeing now. We've had, you know, heat records. I mentioned one at the top just coming out today concerning 2025. We've had record storms in recent days, from Hurricane Melissa just a few weeks ago to in the Caribbean, to four nearly simultaneous typhoons slamming southeastern Asia just over the past week or so, to the possibility that, you know, some 10 million people who live in Iran's capital city of Tehran may soon have to be evacuated due to a years-long drought. That's just news from the past week or two. But with all of that as context here, what is the reason that you see for the lack of action at this year's conference as you see it? You know, I thought for a moment that, hey, the U.S. is not going. Maybe that's a good thing for the conference. What ultimately led to nothing seemingly happening at all there?
Yeah, and you know, it's sometimes said that nature bats last, right? The climate, the Earth system, the global climate doesn't care about the politics of fossil fuel countries and the bickering between petrostates and the rest of the climate system doesn't care. It will just continue to warm up as long as we burn fossil fuels. And all of these impacts that you've described will continue to get worse. We sometimes say, well, you know, it's a new normal that we need to deal with. And there's this whole conversation then about adaptation. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, that sort of sidetracks the conversation. Yes, we need to adapt to those changes that are locked in, that are inevitable, but we will not be able to adapt to the, you know, to the impacts that climate change will continue to have, to the worsening impacts that we will face if we don't stop burning fossil fuels. We will exceed our adaptive capacity. And to those who say, well, we made some progress on adaptation, we made some progress in some of these other areas, to me, it's like deck chairs on the Titanic. Mm. Unless we make progress on decarbonization, none of the rest of that matters. And, you know, that's the bottom line, is there's this, we can feel this sort of, this discordant, it feels discordant to us that at the very time we're seeing worse and worse impacts of climate change, by the day, mm-hmm. we're seeing greater degrees of intransigence. Mm-hmm. And obviously this has to change. I have argued that, that the UN, mm-hmm. and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change has to show some backbone and pass, you know, meaningful measures that won't necessarily get the approval of the bad actors like Saudi Arabia, Russia, and right now the U.S. The planet can't wait.
Well, let me ask you about that. You and others, of course, warn that the clock is, quote, quickly now running out, you mentioned in your piece, Bad Cop. But what does that mean? You know, I think a lot of people think, well, we'll solve this at some point. We'll solve this when we really need to. But in practical terms, what does that mean exactly that the clock is running out? What is that clock? And are we nearing a point in which it cannot be reversed, period, no matter what we do?
Yeah, to sort of borrow from the analogy of the doomsday clock that's, mm-hmm. you know, announced every new year. Yep. And increasingly climate change weighs into that calculation, but so do all the other challenges that we face. But if we're just talking about sort of the climate clock here, we're seconds from midnight in this sense. We have a finite budget, a finite amount of carbon that we can burn and keep the planet below the often quoted 1.5 Celsius for Americans, you know, it's 3 degrees Fahrenheit, basically, mm-hmm. a level of warming beyond which we will see far worse consequences than we've already had, we've already witnessed. And we can actually calculate with some uncertainty how much carbon is left in that budget. And the calculations show that 3 years of business as usual, if we don't begin to ramp down those carbon emissions dramatically over the next few years, if we just continue with business as usual for 3 or 4 more years, then we burn through that budget and we lock in that threshold you referred to earlier. When do we cross that threshold, mm-hmm. where the planet has steadily now warmed beyond 1.5 Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit? That is just a matter of years away in you know, the absence of dramatic action. And here's what's so tragic. If we had acted decades ago, when the IPCC had already announced, the UN IPCC had already announced that human-caused warming was here, that we were seeing the impact of climate change, if politicians around the world, governments around the world had listened to the scientists decades ago, we could have fairly gently sort of decarbonized our societal infrastructure. It would have been sort of a fairly gentle sort of reduction of carbon emissions and a relatively sort of slow, you know, steady move away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. We could have afforded that if we had started acting decades ago. We can't afford that now. We've got to undergo that transition now in a matter of years. And right now, we're clearly not meeting the moment when it comes to these annual climate summits. Something's got to change.
And that's sort of one of the reasons I wanted to point out what, you know, people refer to COP 30, COP 28, COP 29, et cetera.
Yeah.
That stands for 30. We've been doing this now for 30 years, following warnings about all of this. And as you call for or suggest in your bad cop piece, maybe a new format is needed. What about this newly announced conference planned for Colombia in April, co-hosted by the Netherlands? Supposedly, if I'm understanding it, only for nations who are actually interested in phasing out fossil fuels. Is that something along the lines of what you were hinting at in your bad cop piece, calling for perhaps a new format to these annual conferences?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I mean, having that go on in parallel can be helpful, right? Mm-hmm. Because that process can help produce a roadmap, though, that it can't just be 30 or even 80 nations that follow it. Mm-hmm. All of the nations of the world have to follow that roadmap or we fail. And so while that process might be useful in sort of preparing that roadmap, there's no way to avoid the fact that in the end, we need something like COP, the mm-hmm. Conference of the Parties involving all of the countries of the world. As I like to say, borrowing from a phrase that you may remember from decades ago, was used by political figure Jesse Jackson when he was talking about welfare reform. Mm-hmm. And he would say, mend it, don't end it.
Right.
And that's what we have here. We need to mend it, but we can't end it. This is the only global multilateral policy framework we have to deal with a problem that requires cooperation by all of the nations on our planet. Mm-hmm. And again, I've argued that the UN just needs to show some backbone. We don't need a separate process of countries that are willing to commit to a phase out of fossil fuels. We just need the UN to show some backbone and say, look, what we mean by consensus is what you find if you look it up in the dictionary. It doesn't mean every single country. It means the vast majority, maybe at 75% of the countries of the world. And it becomes the law, in a sense. It becomes what countries are expected to do. And there can and should be severe sanctions then by the countries of the world against those holdouts, those nations that fail to do their part. That's what we need.
What do you see as behind that lack of courage by the UN? I mean, the Secretary General has been very, I think, very loud, very good for years now. Actually, a string of successive Secretary Generals have been very good on this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the organization itself is lacking the courage. If so, what? Why do you see that as the case?
Yeah, you know, I think there's some bullies, and we know what that's like here in the United States when our institutions start to, you know, yield to bullying. That is the problem we have in the United States right now. And again, the analogy holds because right now the United States is an authoritarian petrostate. Mm-hmm. Its policies are basically being dictated by polluters and other special interests right now. And there's a relationship between authoritarianism and sort of and resource extraction and fossil fuel extraction. And so right now, obviously here in the United States, we're seeing the consequences of institutions, academic institutions, civil institutions, companies, corporations, other politicians yielding to the bullying by Donald Trump and sort of the MAGA contingent. But that's happening at the global scale too. What happens in the U.S. doesn't stay in the U.S. And that sort of authoritarian bullying is now extending to other countries around the world. And so that battle is now global, and we're seeing the consequences of it here in what's happening at these climate conferences.
You sort of alluded to this a little bit earlier. I want to dive into just a couple of details. You sort of had what is kind of becoming, I think we talked to you about it a year or two ago, but it's sort of becoming a bit of a long-running feud now with former Microsoft chairman Bill Gates. He now heads up the $36 billion global philanthropy fund, the Gates Foundation, focused on supposedly alleviating worldwide poverty, on health, on education. At the end of October, in a piece at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, those are the keepers of the notorious atomic clock you referenced there.
The Doomsday Clock.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you. You responded to a paper that Gates had released, basically suggesting that, well, it's too expensive to stop using fossil fuels, and that money might be better spent figuring out essentially technical solutions, or figuring out how to mitigate, how to survive it somehow, to survive climate change. Am I characterizing his paper correctly? And if so, of course, he is not the only, you know, sort of tech bro out there to suggest such a path forward. Oh,
right.
Well, we'll find a miracle somewhere along the way. Let's just not worry about it too much. What is wrong with his idea as you see it?
Yeah, and it was, I think, very effectively mocked by my friend Adam McKay in the movie Don't Look Up. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen that movie, it's a thinly veiled metaphor for the climate crisis and climate denial. And there's a figure, sort of, to me, who steals the show, who plays one of these tech bros, who essentially is, in the context of, you know, it's a comet that's going to strike the planet and kill off all life on the planet, but a metaphor for the climate crisis. And he offers a geoengineering solution, right, that will make him and his company a whole lot of money, but actually might not save the planet. And so it's a very compelling analogy. Now, that character could be interpreted as sort of, there's definitely some Bill Gates in him. There's some Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, but it's this idea so prevalent now in sort of the big tech world, that this idea that our only tool is a hammer, so everything's got to look like a nail.
Mm-hmm.
If big tech is your world and that's all you think about, then suddenly climate change just seems like, oh, maybe it's just another techno fix, just another problem where we need some techno fix. And the title of my piece was, of course, Bill Gates, if you crash the planet, you can't reboot it.
Yep.
And so
long time, the solution to most Windows problems. Just
yes.
Restarted.
Anybody who struggled through the days of Windows 95 knows exactly what we're talking about here. But there's a thinking there so prevalent. And I think that is what we see in Gates' latest missive. Some people have argued maybe he's currying favor there with the Trump administration, which is very fossil fuel friendly, and all of the sort of billionaire plutocrats in the Republican Party right now. That maybe he's trying to curry favor with them. That Gates is trying to sort of curry favor with the rest of that club by talking down the threat of climate change and offering up, fallacies that are so silly that, if you offered them to a kindergarten class, they would be able to point out what's wrong with the fallacy. This idea that, and he actually said something like, look, if we have to choose between the planet warming up 0.1 degrees Celsius And by the way, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about 3-4 degrees Celsius if we fail to do anything. But so already there's the fallacy, right? 0.1 degrees Celsius, the planet warms up 0.1. Or we solve malaria. I'm going to solve malaria. He might as well have titled his missive, "You Can't Walk and Chew Gum at the Same Time," because that's basically his argument. We can't solve two different problems at the same time. And what makes it even so ridiculous is that Gates actually funded a colleague of mine that I collaborated with a number of years ago, and there's a rich literature now in this area, taking climate projections and looking at the consequences for the spread of malaria. Climate change, the warming from climate change, is going to create far greater prevalence. Lead to a worsening in many regions of the planet and a spread from the tropics into the extratropics of malaria. And so climate change, the warming of the planet, is actually making, you know, these sorts of vector-borne diseases even worse. To the point where there's no way you're going to, you know, do away with malaria on a planet that continues to warm up and becomes more hospitable to the malaria parasite. And so it's just flawed in every way imaginable. And I think I mentioned in the piece, you know, it's offering up these sorts of arguments as if they're serious discourse rather than thinly veiled fossil fuel industry talking points is as embarrassing as being caught with your pants down.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that he sort of downplays from the beginning. Oh, if it's 0.1 degrees of warming versus malaria, I'll deal with malaria anytime. That's kind of very Donald Trumpian, who, you know, talks about, oh, in the next 100 years, the ocean will rise 2 millimeters.
Exactly.
So you just, you know, knock out the whole premise. You create this straw man and just knock it out before the conversation even begins. Interesting that Bill Gates is starting to sound like Donald Trump, isn't it?
You're not suggesting, are you, that he had an audience of one?
I'm just saying it's just an observation. You know,
I think there's something there. I think that's absolutely right.
Well, all of this, it actually seems, sort of ties into your latest book, Science Under Siege: How to Fight the 5 Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World, co-written with Dr. Peter Hotez, a vaccine scientist and a global health advocate. I want to touch on those 5 forces before we let you go to sort of give folks an idea what the book is about. But I find it interesting that you, as a climate scientist, and Dr. Hotez, as a vaccine scientist, are now finding common ground here. Can you explain that, how you sort of both came together to fight, I suppose, what are now common enemies both of your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was about 5 years ago. It was, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, where I was seeing these, you know, vaccinologists, public health scientists like Anthony Fauci, like Peter, being attacked and vilified in exactly the same way that we climate scientists had been attacked and vilified for decades. Mm-hmm. And what was shocking, the tactics were so similar. Mm. The sort of venues, the right wing media, the conservative think tanks, you know, the actual you know, players involved were very much the same. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to Peter early on and said, you know, we should talk. You know, we've been dealing with this sort of stuff for decades. You know, maybe there's some lessons we've learned that will be useful to you and your colleagues. Peter and I became close friends. We realized that we had a book to write about just the commonality in, you know, the assault on climate action and the assault on, you know, vaccines and the public health advice offered by, you know, Peter and Tony Fauci and others about pandemics, these worsening pandemics, COVID-19, just the latest example of something that will continue to get worse if we don't do something about it. Mm. So there's such a commonality between these seemingly disparate problems. Both of them are existential threats, and both of them are even greater threats because of a third overriding threat, which is anti-science and disinformation that paralyzes us and makes it impossible for us to actually make progress. Mm. And so Yeah, we realized we had a book to write. We've sort of talked about like the five forces. It's already come up in our conversation. It's no mystery. It's the plutocrats that we were talking about. It's the petrostates. In fact, I'm a sucker for alliteration. And so it's, you know, there are five P words, the petrostates, the plutocrats. They're also polluters and politicians. Mm. But there are the what we call the pros, people who get money promoting the misinformation and disinformation, the propagandists who help spread it. And we don't give the press a free pass either. And I'm not just talking about the Murdoch media, New York Times. I mean, not just talking about the Wall Street Journal, right. Fox News, the Murdoch media, the right-wing media. I'm talking about even mainstream media outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, that increasingly have engaged in what we call performative neutrality, this idea that they need to platform, you know, anti-science, you know, claims of the lab leak theory or, you know, the claim that vaccines actually cause COVID, things that have been discredited in the scientific community, and yet they're given a platform on the pages of ostensibly mainstream legacy news outlets.
And even doing that, just elevates them, gives them a, you know, some respectability. Even when they're talking about how these things are wrong, it sort of gives them a respectability they do not deserve. I also, as you
were how's the public able to make up their minds when they're bombarded with this misinformation? They don't know who to believe, and that only helps one side. That helps those who are relying on ignorance and paralysis.
Yeah, when Fox News used to call themselves fair and balanced, which is a ghost they've given up long ago. But even when they do that, I used to say, well, fairness is one thing. Balance is another, because it tends to just level the playing field for the bad guys. You know, some things don't deserve balance.
Exactly.
As you were describing the common ground you found with Dr. Hotez, I found it actually kind of ironic, because Bill Gates was, you know, the victim of some of those attacks as well, as he's been doing his own vaccine work around the world.
This is something Peter and I struggled with a little bit in the book. There are a few cases where we didn't, at least initially, see eye to eye. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates has funded a lot of important work in, you know, public health science and the development of vaccines. Obviously, Peter, some of his work has benefited from contributions from Bill Gates, and so he's been a positive force to a large extent in the public health world. But on the other hand, he's been unhelpful, not just with this recent missive. I go much further back than that. For more than a decade, in my view, he has been promoting sort of false paths forward, downplaying the viability of clean energy, saying, no, there's no way that we can transition off fossil fuels yet. So we're going to have to look into geoengineering, or we're going to have to look into modular nuclear reactors. It's like everything but the one obvious solution, which is, as I like to say, if you find yourself in a climate hole, you've got to stop digging and burning fossil fuels. Yeah. And Bill Gates fails to recognize that. So it's been frustrating to have seen that and to be, you know, and I've been sort of pushing back against that for more than a decade. Oddly enough, it was almost helpful to me. That latest missive really opened the eyes of a lot of people who hadn't yet seen that.
And you write that about him and waiting for some miracle technology, that it already exists in solar, wind, geothermal, storage technology, that we don't need to wait for some sort of a breakthrough. We need to work with what we got, and we got to do it quickly. Lastly, Dr. Michael Mann, I have over the years, despite the seemingly worsening state of the climate, not seemingly worsening, actually worsening state of the climate, but it's increasingly dire stakes. I've often marveled, and in fact, I've been inspired and buoyed by your optimism, despite all of that. After Brazil, Mike, and as we head into the holiday season, do you still hold on to that optimism? And if so, what might give you hope right now, and maybe give some hope to the rest of us along the way?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that, Brad. You know, it's what I would say is it's not sort of Pollyannish optimism. It's realistic optimism. Mm-hmm. It's steeped in, you know, my knowledge of the physics of the climate, the science that I do, which tells us that the obstacles aren't physical, they're not technological, they're political. And political obstacles can be overcome. Mm. In the book, you know, the alliteration that was sort of my contribution, one of my contributions, because I'm sort of a sucker for alliteration, as I said before. But one of the other things that I sort of tried to instill was sort of bringing almost a Tolkien-esque sort of framing to the conversation, because this is a Tolkien-esque battle. It's a battle not for Middle Earth, but for Earth itself. Mm. And there so clearly are forces of good and evil that are involved. And I think somehow framing it in those terms can be helpful and clarifying. And there's a line from The Lord of the Rings that we sort of, you know, end on, which is, you know, there's some good in this world and it's worth fighting for. It's about fighting the good fight, even if, you know, the odds don't seem in your favor and the forces against which you're fighting seem overwhelming. The only way you're going to prevail is if you fight the good fight, and that's what we've got to do.
Michael E. Mann is the author of books such as The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dire Predictions, The Madhouse Effect, The New Climate War, Our Fragile Moment, and now Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World, with vaccine expert Dr. Peter Hotez. You can find Michael's work at michaelmann.net, and you can follow him on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at Michael E. Mann. He is, among other things, the Presidential Distinguished Professor of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania, along with many other titles. Dr. Mann, delightful to have you join us as usual, despite the topics. Always great to speak with you. Hope you have a warm and wonderful, but not too warm, holiday season, my friend, and we'll talk to you in the new year.
The same to you, my friend.
Thank you, brother. Okay, always good to talk to him.
Yes.
Always appropriate that he wraps it up with a nerdy reference to
to Lord of the Rings.
To Lord of the Rings.
Yes, absolutely.
Seems only right. Anyway, we have got to get out. Thanks again to Dr. Mann. Thanks, of course, as always, to our producer, Desi Doyen. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or you want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can always do it for free at bradblog.com. That is thanks to those of you who hit one of those donate buttons while you're there to help us stay on your public airwaves. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate to do exactly that. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on social medias, you will find me at the Brad Blog. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.